parts. It's possible that I'll be able to do something in the summertime. And also, what I'd like to do is to devote Econ 575 next fall to an exposition of this theory. So if you think that what I say here makes some kind of sense, please feel free to join Econ 575. That's Bayesian econometrics. The justification for putting something like this in Bayesian econometrics is in the last part of section 11 of this handout that I gave. Okay, well, some of you know that I've been somewhat dissatisfied with the state of economic theory, and I've been trying to find a viable substitute for many years, something I call the FOCUS program, after an acronym for friction, organization, capital, uncertainty, and selection. And I've given a few talks on this in the past, which you may or may not have found plausible, but what I never was able to do was really to wrap it all up so that I was in a position of actually being able to devote something, to develop something that is so elaborate that it became a nucleus for the development of what you might call a rival to the received theory. Well, if you have an idea that is basically correct, sooner or later it will bear fruit. And what has happened, it seems to me, that is that I have actually made some kind of breakthrough, so that this is indeed bearing fruit later rather than sooner. But I'm still alive and kicking, and so there should be plenty of time to set this up. What I'd like to convince you of today is that this is at least a plausible way of looking at the world. I mean, I cannot convince you that it's actually a superior way of looking at the world to receive economic theory, although I will have to do that eventually if this is to form a viable competitor to receive ideas and to overcome the enormous inertia that that received ideas have. So, as I say, what I'd like to do is, what you should do is try to get a feel for the overall vision of what's going on. This, however, I don't conceive as just a kind of philosophical rambling discussion. It's one that, in principle, should generate models. This is not itself a model, but it's, you can call it an apparatus deducing models. And, well, in any case, I think with that I will just begin launching this. What's wrong with received economic theory? Well, there are two things that bothered me. One thing is it didn't take account of a lot of features of the real world, which are palpable to everyday experience, space, time, and a couple of other things like that. And secondly, it didn't seem to me general enough. That is, what is called general equilibrium theory is actually not sufficiently general in the sense that a lot of the premises of general equilibrium theory seem to me something that should be endogenous to economic theory rather than exogenous. And one of my aims here is to make a lot of other things endogenous, and you'll see that I do this with a vengeance. My nearest competitor here, I think, is Gary Becker, who is known as the prime economics imperialist. As you'll see, I make Becker look like a piker in that particular respect. But we'll see if I can actually carry out this this particular program in detail. It's very easy to criticize general equilibrium theory. For example, Frank Hahn, who has written, is the co-author of the leading textbook on the subject, has made a career almost out of saying what's wrong with general equilibrium theory. He's on perfectly safe ground, provided you do not have a viable alternative. You cannot beat something with nothing, and as long as there's not a construction that's elaborate enough and plausible enough to be a viable rival for general equilibrium theory, it's perfectly safe. And what I hope to show is that indeed I have at least the makings of a plausible rival theory. It's one, I might say, in terms of my own experience, I'm not quite sure exactly why these things are coming together now, but for the first time in my my intellectual career, I'm actually discovering things faster than my planned upon timetable. My overall timetable was about 10 years behind. I had hoped to be where I am now roughly 10 years ago, but these things are hard to predict. In any case, let me just begin. Okay, on the general subject of general equilibrium theory, let's turn first to the last two pages of this. And what I did is list a whole bunch of innovations in economic theory. Most of these are post-1970, with the object of seeing how many of these are actually compatible with general equilibrium theory. So I think if you compiled your own list, it would be somewhat different, but they'd be an overlap of probably something like 70% with this list. Okay. Let's just say all of them. I mean, they're all variants of one another. I mean, if you want to define general equilibrium, it would consist of a number of households which maximize utility, a number of firms which maximize profits. I'm not dealing with things of that particular level of concreteness. What I'm dealing with the whole intellectual climate that produces models of that particular sort. I'm thinking of perfect competition as quote John. I mean, for the purpose of this particular thing, if an innovation departs from perfect competition, I didn't give it a star. Okay, so star means that it's compatible with general equilibrium theory. For example, computable general equilibrium is obviously compatible in a sense and so forth. These are subjective estimates. And it turns out of these 101 innovations, I think there are 39 asterisks, so that most of what's happening in recent years in economic theory is actually incompatible with general equilibrium theory for one reason or another. Actually, I think what you really want the central paradigm of your discipline to do more than just be compatible. You want it actually to suggest the way of going. So if I had a more strict criterion and say how many of these particular innovations are actually suggested by by the formulation of general equilibrium theory rather than being merely compatible with it, I'd have a much smaller collection of stars. So what I'm looking for is to replace this with another paradigm that not only can embrace just about all of these innovations over here, but actually suggest the way to go to the future. Well, okay, well, very ambitious. Let's just see what the thing looks like. And on the first page inside is a kind of block diagram or outline of what the focus principle is. Excuse me, over here. There's something at the very head of it, which I'll call the selection principle. And this thing in the upper left-hand corner, perfect adaptation and perfect markets, functions, for me, somewhat like general equilibrium theory. It has some resemblance to that, but it's much less important in the overall scheme of things, because what I'm putting at the center place is not a system of equations, but a principle, basically a way of thinking about the world. That's the selection principle. And what I've done here is just list various 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 things, and under each one, the kinds of topics that that would be covered by these particular titles. Okay, let me begin, and let me start by making a couple of suggestions to the point that the distinction between firms and households is much less strict than you might gather from just reading the United States books. Let's see if we can try three rank of differences between them. Households have a finite lifespan, but actually so do firms. My impression is that the great majority of firms in existence are 100 years old. Probably the average lifespan of firms is something comparable to the average life of people. What else? Well, firms have the technology, but so do households. That's the whole human capital approach to family structure. Households have a budget constraint, but in the real world, so do firms. And in fact, a hard budget constraint, as Bernard reminds us. Okay, finally, how about preferences? Well, let's just think of the following type of argument. Suppose we had entities, economic agents. I won't try to specify whether they are firms or households. And let's suppose that what I've done is devise a rather trivial type of model to illustrate what I call the selection principle. Okay, let's suppose that an agent has to choose between two options, let's say periodically in time. You're faced with a choice between two things, and one of these things increases your wealth by 1% and the other decreases your wealth by 1%. So in other words, if you choose this particular option, you multiply your wealth by 1.01. If you choose this other option, you multiply your wealth by 0.99. And let's suppose a particular agent has a certain parameter R such that with probability 1 plus R over 2, you choose this option. And with probability 1 minus R over 2, you choose this particular option. Why don't firms always choose, or whatever it is, why don't they always choose the option which maximizes wealth? Well, there could be a number of reasons. There could be imperfect perception. I'm not quite sure which of your options does that. Or it could be you're interested in other things. You may have some other goals which have nothing directly to do with wealth. And just by coincidence, let's say, these other goals happen to 1 plus R over 2 fraction of the time, they happen to lead to this choice which is favorable for wealth, and the other fraction of the time, they happen to lead to this choice which is unfavorable. And we'll assume that this sort of thing happens over and over again, and that successive choices are independent of one another, but with the same R going through. Okay, what's going to happen after a long period? Well, the answer is that at time t, this is theorem 1 on page 1 here. Very, very simple result, but I think it illustrates the basic principle as well. At time t, in other words, after t periods have gone by, the expectation of wealth at time t divided by initial wealth is 1.01 R to the power t. And the proof is really quite trivial. Think of a random variable, let's say x1, which takes 0.01 or 0.99 with these respective probabilities. So x1 is what your wealth is multiplied by after the first period. Similarly, x2 is what your wealth is multiplied after the second period up through xt. These are independent, and so this factor over here is the factor by which your overall wealth is multiplied by. The expected ratio is then the expectation of this product, and since they're independent, it's the expectation of each one to the power t, since they all have the same expectation, which is 1 plus 0.01 R to the power t. You can easily calculate the expectation of this particular random variable is 1 plus R divided by 100. And you can approximate this by e to the R t over 100. Okay, well, now let's suppose you have a population of a whole bunch of these agents with R distributed in the population. In other words, some agents have an R. R has to be in the range between 0, minus 1, and plus 1. So you have a certain distribution of this R in the population. Now let's say here's minus 1, here's plus 1. You have some kind of distribution. I don't know what it is, representing at time 0. What fraction of the population has R values in these various ranges? My question is, what's going to happen over time in terms of the distribution of these things? I should say another thing. This is measured by total wealth. Okay. So in other words, what this says is You take the total wealth in the economic system and the total wealth that is owned by agents having an R value between this level and this level is given by this particular figure. At least that's the fraction of total wealth. Okay. The question is, what happens to the distribution of wealth over the parameter R as time goes by? Well, you can easily see this increases with R. It's an increasing function of R, so that if we were to write minus 1 plus 1 to R, you have something like that. That's this particular function between that. That's figure 1 on page 1. And it's easy to see that what happens is that this particular initial distribution gets multiplied by this particular factor, so you get a movement upward. You get a skewed distribution toward the right. This particular thing has gone up to something that begins to look like. Furthermore, the bigger T gets, the more this skew occurs. Until in the long run, you get an overwhelming push. Wealth in general accumulates at the high end of the spectrum, and essentially everybody ultimately will be at the highest R that anybody initially had. I say this, you don't necessarily go all the way up to if the initial distribution stopped over here at, let's say, 0.4, then there's nothing for this selection to work on. Essentially, the entire wealth will pile up at 0.4. That's the way this works. That's the way natural selection works. You have to have some initial form of variation for this selective process to work on. Okay, well, I mean, this is almost trivial, and I make a few comments right after that. First of all, if learning takes place, we haven't said anything about modification of R's. That's just supposed to be a given. But if learning takes place, you say, well, look, I mean, I'm running out of wealth compared to my neighbors because I have a relatively small R. Let me alter my behavior in such a way that R rises. And you can see that learning might well take place if somebody is observant. And even if you're not particularly concerned with wealth as something you want to attain in any sense, wealth is in a certain sense the universal means to whatever else you want to do. So if you want to become the world's greatest saint or something, typically you will need some form of wealth to do it, and therefore maybe purely as a means you might decide to have a sharper perception and alter your R toward the higher values. So learning, if anything, just accelerates this process. Now, I've had 1.01 and 0.99, so the average is 1, but actually this kind of argument still holds even if there's an upward tilt. I mentioned the case, suppose this is 1.05 and 1.03, so again, they differ by 0.02. In terms of relative wealth, you get exactly the same result as before. The only difference is that you have an upward growth of the entire system of 4% per period on the average above that. But the distribution of wealth among different economic agents will have exactly the same pattern as before.
So there's no constraints here for buying wealth? Everybody's R goes up to plus 1?
Well, I mean, my original assumption was that people's R do not change. I mean, here's another example of the same thing. Suppose you have a bunch of firms. This, of course, is really a familiar argument, but it's certainly not something that's stressed in textbooks. Suppose you have a bunch of firms in an industry, and they have a distribution of behavior. Some of them are very profit-oriented. Some of them just take it easy, some go fishing, things like that. You will find a gradual redistribution of wealth from the non-profit-oriented firms to the profit-oriented firms. Same question. Okay, let's see. And I also mentioned that you don't even have to be consciously pursuing wealth in any sense. You might be doing something entirely different. I think the natural world is a good example here. Presumably, animals are not consciously trying to maximize their biomass in any sense. But that's the way it works out. With this kind of principle, you call it natural selection, and you apply it to the natural world, is selecting those kinds of behaviors which contribute to overall quietness. It's really the basic Darwinian argument, which incidentally he derived from Malthus and directly by inspiration. So it's coming back to economics, so to speak. Okay, now, crucial question. You can think of this as applying to firms. Why doesn't it apply to households? Answer is, there's no reason why it shouldn't apply to households. This particular argument is quite universal, and it seems to me that it does apply to households. That's really quite the point. Now, why, therefore, do we have this distinction in economic theory between firms which maximize profits and households who maximize utilities? I think the answer is in what you might call technological accidents, so to speak, as far as household activities are concerned and firm activities are concerned. First of all, households are operating in a condition which has lots of missing markets and imperfect markets. You do not sell labor outright. At best, you rent it. There's a long, long gestation period in households, and prior generation goes by. And we are very uncertain of the technology involved in households. That is to say, if you're a firm and you are growing corn, basically you will discover efficient and inefficient ways of growing corn. If you're growing children, it's much harder to figure out if you're doing something correct or if you're not doing something correct. It will take a generation to verify, and even then, the signals are weak because you do not have an immediate market signal as to whether you are doing well or nonetheless, the basic validity of this seems to me to apply also to households as well as to firms. Okay, and figure two shows is the following. You've got, the simplest thing in the world is to think of a trade-off between investment and consumption, for example. And I just rewrite this as wealth over here, which you can think of corresponding to investment, and I just call it pleasure, but it doesn't have to be something corresponding to consumption. And our usual conception is almost universal in development models to think of there as being a kind of trade-off between these two things like this. But if this particular selection process occurs over and over again, then what's going to happen is that wealth will be distributed to people for whom there's not a trade-off like this, but so to speak, a positive correlation. So that's what I'm trying to illustrate in that figure two. There's another alternative. Here's wealth again, and here's pleasure. So those families, those households, those firms will prosper even if they're pursuing purely pleasure, not concerned at all about wealth, provided there is a strong correlation. So you choose a point that's up over here, you will indirectly choose a point that's up over there. That's what I'm trying to illustrate by figure two.
But I thought you said like if firms sell them go out fishing.
Yeah.
Their wealth transfers to the people who are working hard. Now you're saying if we go fishing, we're going to, if it's correlated with catching lots of fish and bringing us money, it's going to bring us
wealth. I wasn't thinking of that. But I was thinking of something like this. Suppose you have people who get pleasure out of work, famous workaholics like that. In that case, even if they're not working to get wealth, they will automatically accrue wealth. Take another example, the Protestant ethic thesis. What does that say? Well, it says that the initial, according to Max Weber, the people who became Protestants were very concerned about the salvation of their soul. So they did various things. It turned out that what they did turned out to be correlated with wealth accumulation. So this was the nub of early capitalism. And I'm not saying I accept this theory, but that would be the same sort of phenomenon. You'd find a positive correlation developing between the Protestant ethic and and wealth accumulation. Yes.
It seems like you just talked about a joint product situation. That one activity is giving forth a couple products.
No problem at all with that one, though. Mm-hmm. Okay, now let me go on to step three, or paragraph three on page two. And let's take, so, I mean, if there is some just general tendency of this particular sort, then it makes some kind of sense to try to explore what happens when this particular process has gone to the limit. And it's what I call perfect adaptation. In other words, not merely firms maximize profits, but everybody maximizes profits. And what I do is just indicate a few preliminary interpretations or results of this. One of them is the income concept. As you know, one doesn't really study this too much in graduate school, but undergraduate courses talk about the concept of national income and all of the paradoxes that are concerned with it. You break your leg and increase the national income and so forth and so on. And from the point of view of general equilibrium theory, income isn't all that important a concept. From my point of view, it turns out to be a very important concept, and therefore I'm concerned with it. Well, for firms, income and saving are essentially the same. In other words, a firm's income is the same as a firm's saving, is the same as the change in the net worth of a firm. But for households, what you do is stick this extra item in bold. So that household income is the same as household saving plus household consumption. And that's really the source of all of these paradoxes, or almost all of these paradoxes. And the suggestion I make is the following. Let's take the firm as the correct way of looking at this. Let's in fact try to identify income with saving for firms, and also for households. So what's wrong? I mean, why should we do that? Don't we have the concept of saving already? The answer is the concept of saving, as it indicates, as it appears in national income accounts, is not comprehensive enough. If we were to draw a household's balance sheet, we have various assets over here, you know, land, plant, household equipment, and so forth and so on. But the biggest single item would be there, at least as drawn by ordinary accounting standards, and that is you. Your own body is the most important thing you own by far. I mean, your human capital is invested in that. For most of us, that's by far the most important source of future earnings and so forth and so on. And therefore, when you consider changes in net worth, you want to count in also accumulation of human capital. So what I'm saying is what you need is a broad concept of saving, one in which involves accumulation of human capital, and that is what I think you should identify with the income concept. You get one uniform income concept, both for firms and for households, and you'll see in all of these cases that all of these paradoxes disappear. For example, breaking your leg. Okay, what's recorded is the extra income of hospitals and physicians and so forth and so on. What isn't recorded is, in fact, your human capital has decreased when your leg gets broken. And presumably it decreases by more than the extra income of hospitals and so forth. So when you take that into account, those things, those particular paradoxes disappear. In fact, my suggestion is this. The reason that one uses consumption in the national product is really as a kind of proxy for things that you can't measure. There's no direct way of measuring accumulation of human capital. When you can't measure outputs, next best thing you do is measure them by the amount of inputs that are going into that. That's the way you would measure government product, for example. And what I'm saying is this. If you think of consumption as a proxy for this sort of thing, then if that's true, that means that national income statisticians and so forth really had this concept behind in back of their minds all the way through. I mean, you can try to do this in terms of, let's say, reading the canonical text of Quiznes and so forth, but at least this gives you a consistent way of looking at it. And the paradoxes arise precisely when measured consumption turns out an obvious poor proxy you're trying to measure, which is the accumulation.
Arnold, what's human capital? What I have in mind is there a role for pleasure in here, or is human capital just as typically used a proxy for future productive power? In other words, my trip to Hawaii, I mean, is that increasing human capital?
Well, I mean, pleasure itself, of course, is a flow concept in a sense. Well, human capital.
We could have the accumulated
concept.
Stock of pleasure if we want. I want to know what wealth is, what
right.
human
okay.
capital
well,
is.
Well, remember, we're discussing a situation of perfect adaptation so that your pleasure and your accumulation of wealth are perfectly harmonious with one another.
I'm talking about measured concepts, since you're talking about measured concepts. So if I undertake an activity which doesn't enhance my human capital as I might understand that from a Becker sense, the term human
right.
capital
right.
from there, then that doesn't reflect perfect adaptation in the way you're using the term.
Let me talk about imperfect adaptation later on.
But I'm just asking, is there a role for pleasurable activities in the model? Or is it?
Yes.
Well, that's what I'm trying to find out, whether the flow of utility is somehow in the stock. But then talking about wealth accumulated
okay,
in the context of some selection process
yeah.
of market power is not consistent.
Okay. I mean, the quick answer to your question is no, there is no direct role for pleasure if there is a disharmony, as of course there always is in the real world. The reason is what I want to do is to take these values and, in effect, have present value be a reflection of future value. So that portion of your activity, which is, so to speak, wasted in high living, well, maybe I shouldn't say wasted, but goes up in high living, doesn't appear in the future.
Okay, so the only role for consumption is to enhance my productive power for the future, essentially.
Well, I mean, I don't want to make a value judgment here.
When you formulate your accounts and define savings and wealth and so on, and you're saying consumption is then just a proxy, essentially, for these investment activities.
Well, you're actually getting to points which are not completely decided by the law. So let me hold on that. Maybe we can get back to that when it comes to the question of imperfect adaptations. So much for the income concept. Let me also talk about the kind of stuff you get in Econ 50 whatever it is. Okay.
50X.
Yeah, right. Okay. Isoport map. Theory of the firm, isoport map. Inputs, X1, X2. Theory of the household, indifference map. Inputs, X1, X2. From this point of view, the simplest way of interpreting what this means is that this is actually an isoquant map for the production of human capital. These would be consumer goods. They are raw materials which are going into the plant, so to speak. And they are producing human capital. So what I'm saying is there's actually a complete analogy between these two cases. Consumer goods is being raw materials. And I also point, that's over here, I also say this paragraph will take any use of it. And utility function also. Let's say as a function of consumer goods could be interpreted as a production function. Capital with these being the raw materials. That's just another, just again, you think of consumer goods as being inputs into this process. This has rather strong implications for the whole idea of measurable utility, which I can't go into.
So, what happens if heroin is on one axis and marijuana is on the other axis for the consumer diagram? So as you go out higher,
there's a squeeze between pleasure and wealth accumulation again. That would be as much of a question. I presume that you've given me two things which are actually destructive rather than productive.
Yeah, I would assume that they might be destructive.
Right. Well, I mean,
but they could get you at the higher level.
In this perfectly adapted world, people do not consume those things.
Understand. One of the things that in human capital and household production theory is the confounding between taste and technology. You've got technology producing human capital, but yet that's evaluated by your utility function, which is taste. Are you saying now that you've combine them completely, or you unbundle them?
Well, in the perfect adaptation case, taste would actually be a synonym for ecology. Ecology in the household sector.
So there are no more tastes. Everything is just technology.
In this perfect adaptation case. No, I don't claim that that describes the real world. It's an ideal limit. It's similar to the idea of assuming that firms maximize profits. Real world firms do not maximize profits. They might come close. That's a good approximation of what real world firms do. I would say that this sort of thing, in some cases, comes close to what actual households do. And if it doesn't come close to what households do now, wealth tends to be redistributed to those households who do approximate for what this particular theory of predicting. Okay, the next thing is assuming, now this is a change in topic completely. Assume perfect markets in continuous time. The following kind of considerations apply also to early delivery, but when I'm thinking of competitive markets over time, I'm not even sure that these particular considerations are original. You probably can dig them out of a book like Christopher Bliss's On Capital Theory. Okay, suppose you have a unit of account. And I want to take time seriously here. So a unit of account consists of the following. What you have is, let's say, PIT would be the vector of prices of all stocks in the system at time t, according to unit of account I, as measured at time t. For example, if you take the dollar of a unit account, PIT would be the dollar value of all stocks in the system. Not only those things that are measured in dollars, but via exchange rates, via all stocks in the entire world. So that's PIT. That would be one thing. And you, to complete this picture, what you have to have is own interest rates, which in effect are giving you the relative values of this unit account across time. How do you define that sort of thing? Well, 1 plus R of T, let delta be a small interval of time. So it's T plus delta. So this thing over here is the number of units of T plus delta units of account which exchange for one unit of account at time T. That's the, as at least as delta gets smaller than first zero. That's the basic definition of own rate of interest. Okay, now suppose you have two units of account. And suppose that pi of t is the conversion factor from unit of account I to unit of account j. In other words, pi of t is the number of I units trading to one j unit. At t. In other words, this the trade between them itself can depend on t. I'm assuming that pi of t is a positive differential function of time. Now, this unit of account can be an actual commodity, it could be a currency, or it could be completely artificial. That doesn't matter. This formula is quite general. And on this basis, we get the following equations, which have to hold. Let ri be the own rate of interest in unit of account I. Let Rj be the own rate of interest in unit of account j, then you get that result. Okay, and this is really, you can derive this in the same way as covered interest arbitrage. It's the same kind of principle that's involved. Okay, so that's result number one. Result number two, let's consider the concept of inflation. Well, here's FO. Rate of inflation is going to be at time t. Rate of inflation at time t will equal PI dot. Incidentally, dot is anything dot is dp dt. PI dot, what we need is a system of weights for the various commodities. Let's say x of t is the vector of weights that we do. For example, the stocks of these particular things in existence would be a possible system of weights. Okay. So what this is simply the multiplication of these prices at time Y, expressed in units of count T, multiplied by these respective weights and added up as the inner product over here. And you do the same thing over here with the rates of change of these prices. And this is more or less a standard definition of inflation in terms of continuous time. It leads to the so-called Lebesgue price index. Okay, and similarly, FJT would be the same thing with J over there. Okay, then we have the following result. Again, it's a very short proof. These are all 1 and 2 point proofs. You get Fi minus Fj equals pi dot over pi, which has a resemblance to so-called purchasing power parity, but it actually isn't, because these are global indexes. You're not talking about the index of one region or one country. PI and PJ go over all stocks in the entire economic system, including across all countries if there are countries. So this is a theorem, whereas we know from Walter Ender's expositions that purchasing power parity is false. This is not the truth, but it's tautologous. Okay, now putting these two together, you come up with Ri minus Fi equals Rj minus Fj, and it's very natural to define this as the real rate of interest in terms of unit of account I, real rate of interest in terms of unit of account j, and what this is saying is the concept of real rate of interest doesn't depend on unit of account. So we can just speak of the real rate of interest. Okay, this of course does depend on the particular system of weights chosen. Later on, I will indicate that you cannot choose these weights arbitrarily. It's one to have an index number that makes theoretical sense. Okay, and finally, we can define the concept of growth rate of the economy. For this particular thing, X has to be stocks. T is the vector of stocks at prime T. That's it. Otherwise, this particular formula wouldn't make too much sense. Okay. So that's what it is. And it looks like it gives you a quantity index. That's the growth rate. And that is also independent of the unit of account, because changing units of account will just multiply numerator and okay, so you can call this real growth rate. Okay, now, we've talked about the concept of perfect adaptation. We've talked about the concept of perfect markets. The next thing I want to do is to put them together. Okay, and that's that first box on the page over here. That's in this corner over here. Perfect adaptation and perfect markets, and you get some rather half-surprising results when you put these two things together. Okay, we take some unit of account. Doesn't matter which. And the following has to hold. First of all, you have perfect markets with profit maximization by everybody. That means that the basic equation of capital theory has to hold. And I'll write it in this particular form. R times P equals P dot plus W. Okay, let me define these terms. R is the own rate of interest. P is the vector of prices. All of these things are functions of time. And W is the rewards per unit time, in other words, your earnings. Think of W as being a kind of wage or rental. Earnings per unit of time of units of various resources. The vector of wages. Remember, we have perfect markets, so there's, at any one point, there exists prices and rental levels for all of these things. How do you derive this particular thing? Well, you can take your present value formula, just differentiate with respect to time, and you get this. This actually dates from Samuelson, 1937. very ancient result. Okay, the second thing is this. Let's interpret X as being the stocks of all of the resources in the system. W times X is then the total earnings of all the resources in the system. That is, you take a particular stock, here's the amount of it in existence, you multiply by its wage rate or rental rate, that's the total amount that stock is earning. You add this up with all stocks, you get this. So this is what's called world income. Okay, now let's consider P times X. That's really world product. Using this amended concept of income or output that I talked about before. That's world product. It's I mean, if we were looking at a firm, this would simply be the way you measure value added in that particular firm. The rate of increase of the stocks in that firm, each multiplied by the respective prices. Well, these have to be equal. That's the basic national income accounting identity. So PX dot equals WX. From these two, we conclude that rate of interest equals rate of growth. And real rate of interest equals real rate of growth. Take this thing, multiply it through by the vector of stocks. Nothing but Px dot. In other words, the rate of change of Px, total wealth. So, the own rate of interest is equal to the relative rate of growth. Well, furthermore, if you take it in this particular form, let's see, I'm going to take it like this.
Before you raise that, why am I obliged to accept the fact that PX dot is world product? In other words, the assumption is that the only use to which output is put is to augment these stocks.
Well, that harks back to my previous discussion.
Right. And the role of consumption or the lack of it in the model. Uh-huh. Consumption only is organic productive capital.
Well, I mean consumption in a literal sense is consumption. When you burn a ton of coal in a firm, that's invariably subtracted from the national product. When you burn a ton of coal in a household, that's not subtracted. And the point I was trying to make before is the reason that's not subtracted is because there are invisible products.
Yeah, but WX, we can agree, is one measure of the gross value of production at one time. Why that has to be equal to PX dot is the supposition of how all that income is being disposed.
Well,
towards augmenting the stock.
There are some problems here. My own guess is that when you look at this closely, this has to be true. I mean, income is coming from somewhere. What's the form that this income is taking?
Well, it goes back to what X is, what a stock is, what it produces, and so on.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I mean, if there's a stock of accumulated things, pleasure in there, then perhaps. But if some of that WX,
right,
the squigglies coming out, widgets or whatever, is used not to augment a productive stock X, mm-hmm, then that is identity of what you're
right
using.
Okay, I think that's probably
the
right.
Identity doesn't hold.
Okay, that would be the case of imperfect adaptation, which I'm coming to.
That's the use of the word imperfect, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure you want to use the word trying. I'm not sure I want to be accused of being a materialist. And I'm not necessarily rejecting that particular term. I would have some problem with the word trying because this adaptation process can occur even if people are not consciously trying to do this sort of thing. In other words, nature itself, so to speak, is selecting this kind of behavior behind the scenes. I'll agree, there's a kind of moxie in play with the whole thing. And as somebody mentioned von Neumann, this is somewhat close to the von Neumann model, which you'll notice also comes out with some conclusions. This, however, is actually more general than von Neumann because I don't specify anything about technology. I don't have to worry about technology. This works purely in terms of price relations.
Why do we want to accumulate access? Why do we want to start the ways to grow? We have the model, the agents, somebody who's making the perfect adapters, whomever they are.
You're making a moral judgment now? I'm not quite sure.
You have by using term perfect and imperfect adaptation.
Well, yeah.
Implicitly added that moral judgment to it.
No, I don't want to use the word perfect in the sense of a moral judgment. I think you can talk about a perfect.
Okay. So, is this meant to be a description of the way
No, it's perfect in the sense that you're carrying a tendency to the limit. So when you carry that tendency completely to the limit, here's what you get. In the real world, this tendency is never carried to the limit, if for no other reason is that the environmental conditions are changing.
Okay, what is the system of equations describing? We have a system of equations, and I'm just asking what we're trying to describe with the system of equations.
What happens in the limit?
What happens where? In the model, or in Mars, or in the world, or what?
I've made some assumptions. You've got this.
Sure. I mean, the mathematics is fine. I'm just asking what the mathematics is being used to describe.
It's being used to describe this ideal limit. When we talk about general equilibrium, talk about general equilibrium. This is where selection has gone to the limit in some sense. Right. I mean, I want to see, just like you say, look, markets tend to a perfect competition. Firms tend to a position where they maximize profits. Okay, let's explore that. That's really the kind of entering wedge for general equilibrium theory. I'm doing something very similar. I'm saying, look, you've got these tendencies. Let's take a look at what happens as if we let these tendencies go to the limit. I do not think this is an actual description of the world. At best, it's an approximation to
but
how
you are saying it's a selection towards correlation.
There is some selection towards, but it never gets. It's
all right.
Like.
You are fostering a fantasy.
I do, yes. I think the selection principle definitely is a behavioral reality. But it's something like the surface of the ocean. There's a tendency for it to become flat under gravity, but it's constantly being whipped up under the surface. Yeah.
And the biologists will talk about selfish genes, where they're trying to maximize the probability of passing the genes on from next generation.
Right.
And if organisms don't do that, they'll die out. Okay? So that in perfect adaptation, the organisms will find a niche, and there'll be lots of organisms.
Right.
And we could talk about reasons why organisms that don't do that just die out.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of your individuals here, I don't understand why someone who has more X just doesn't survive on into the future. I mean, you've never really given a mechanism, at least that I've heard and understood here, that tells me why having more X is a good thing as opposed to having...
You mean more wealth.
And we haven't really, when you haven't said what this wealth is, and I think that's what's troubling me, is it wealth now? Is it wealth when I die?
Wealth has a time index. It's wealth at some particular time, and this wealth changes over
time. So if I don't need anything for the next 2 years, say, except subsistence, is my wealth going up or down?
Well, I'd have to know a little bit more about it. It makes a
difference if you just say there's this thing called wealth and the organism is trying to maximize it. That's fine.
I'm not postulating this thing called wealth. I identify wealth with what is actually the way people actually measure wealth. The only trouble is you've got lots of missing markets. In other words, you've got, in fact, I'll give an argument later on to indicate that most markets in some sense or other are missing. So you've got of the vast quantity of resources in the world and the vast possibilities of exchanging them, most of these aren't realized because these markets So what you've got to do is to is impute these particular values. Oh yes, absolutely.
So
I mean,
that's
sure. Yeah, well, not even going to work the above subsistence.
Okay, above subsistence, I said, because then when we get into these different issues of...
Because
okay. Then I want to know, isn't there really just utility? Isn't that what we're really talking about? And you're going to say no. And that's what
I'm not quite sure what you mean by isn't there really just utility. I mean, I'm... well, I mean, this is a part of the thing that I haven't developed. Well, I won't even discuss this. Let me continue. I mean, what I want to do is to get the big picture across. This is just one little picture. This is really just one corner of the whole thing. And what I'd like to do, if you can indulge me and just confine yourself to clarifying questions to give me a chance to get through on a one shot. I mean, later exhibitions of this, I'll be happy to engage in debates, but I think time is running short. That's all right. Okay, let me, so we have this, and you've got this thing over here, so that R, the own rate of interest, is equal to the increase of R equals Px, dot over Px. Okay, now break this up into P dot x over Px plus Px dot over Px. Subtract this from both sides. This, you'll notice, is just the rate of inflation. And this thing over here is the real rate of growth. Therefore, the real rate of interest equals the real rate of growth. That's one of the things that comes from here. Okay, let me say one quick word about index numbers, because this leads me to a rumination about index numbers, which, oddly enough, I have never seen in the literature, and that literature is quite vast. And that is, that's the following. Over here, for this to make sense, F has to be measured in terms of stocks, that is the weights. The P dot X over the Px has to be measured in terms of stocks, because if you don't have stocks, WS doesn't make any sense. So you're forced over here for this particular conclusion. In practice, index numbers are always made not in terms of stocks, but in terms of flows. In other words, you'll construct a inflation rate in terms of these X's being typically rates of flow. There is something fundamentally amiss about that whole procedure. For one thing, flows can be positive or negative. If you got some of these x's positive and some of these x's negative, you're going to run into all kinds of paradoxes, cases where a price rises but the price index falls. So I think there's something fundamentally flawed in using flows as weights, and the conjecture I make right after this is that the only, quote, theoretically valid, unquote, index numbers are those which use stock weights. And I make one or two suggestions as to how actual index numbers would be biased in comparison with these ideal index numbers based on stock weights. Actual index numbers would underweight durable goods relative to non-durable goods because the ratio of stock to flow would be higher durables and non-durables, and it would be more volatile than the true index number, simply because stocks being an integral are smoother than flow. Okay, well, that's something to be thought about in the future. Okay, then I give as a generalization for local sectors, I won't go through that, that's on the next page 4. The conclusion is that all sectors of the economy are growing at the same rate. In other words, here's a, let's say, a single agent or a country or something like that. The amount of wealth you have over here is growing at a certain rate. The amount of wealth any other country or any other agent or so forth is growing at a rate which is proportional. All of these bars are equal. So in other words, growth rates are equal all over the system in this particular, that's another conclusion. Okay. Now, I should say that this doesn't involve steady growth. We're not saying that quantities themselves are growing at a steady rate. They can be doing anything. We're not saying prices themselves are growing or shrinking at any steady rate. It's only the product of the two that has the property of growing at this constant rate, which is equal to the real rate of interest. Okay, and finally, I have a suggested generalization to the case of uncertainty. If all wealth all over the world grows at the same rate, that means that the fraction of wealth that any one agent or any one country has is going to be constant. In other words, let's say you have a certain sector, let's say VI is the total amount of wealth in that sector. Let's say V is the total wealth of the entire economic system. Then VI over V will be constant if all sectors grow at the same rate. There's a natural generalization of it, and that would be that wealth grows according to a martingale process. Or I should say that the fraction of the total pie that you possess changes as a martingale process. And in fact, this little theorem down here, is a very simple case where this works. You've got common information. You assume that there's an equality of interest rates and growth rates, and current wealth is the expected present value of future wealth, then the agent share is a proportion. Okay, calculus of values, I'll skip over that. Theory of action, I'll skip over that. Skip over causality. Imperfect adaptation, okay? That's really the kind of thing we've been brooding around in terms of discussion for the last period of time. Imperfect adaptation is precisely the case when different sectors of the economy do not grow at the same rate, so you have real redistribution occurring from one sector to the other. For example, the very fact that countries of the world appear to be growing at different rates indicates you cannot have had a perfect adaptation according to this. So what happens then is that the faster growing sectors of the economy accumulate larger and larger shares of wealth relative to the slower growing sectors. Let's see if I want to further discussion of the. I will talk about the other consequences. Okay. Now let me go to imperfect markets. First of all, a quick argument to show that not only are most markets imperfect, but most markets don't even exist. When you think of production, you start with a certain resource over here, a resource bundle, and you end up with another resource bundle. Here's time going by. Necessarily, you have to go through a series of intermediate stages, these intermediate goods. For example, transportation. Okay, transportation, you've got something located at this point. At the beginning of the process, you end up at this point. At the end of the process, you have to cover all of the intermediates. You have a continuum of intermediate goods over here. Each of these, in principle, is a different commodity. I mean, the location is part of the definition of a commodity, and therefore, you really have a continuum of different commodities. The vast bulk of these do not have markets. The economic system functions something like a limited access highway. You're traveling around the highway, you get on and off only at various selected points. That's precisely the points where markets exist. And the reason for this is very simple when you think about it. There's an overhead cost involved in setting up a market, overhead cost involved in getting people to begin thinking this is a commodity that can't be traded. Clearly, there's a limited number of possibilities over there, so that all of these vast quantities of intermediate goods do not have markets. So why think about them at all? Well, there are two different reasons. First of all, they could conceivably get markets in the future. In other words, it's an economic decision that's been made as to whether this good or this other good turns out to have a market. Okay, so in any case, I think the case for the existence of imperfect markets has been established, if it needed to be. And I now come to the integration of macroeconomics and microeconomics, which is another part of this program. Perhaps before I go on, I should talk about a few things which I hope to make endogenous. I say that was endogeneity with a vengeance. I've already talked about trying to make people's utility functions endogenous in various ways. I want to integrate macroeconomics and microeconomics. Let me just mention one other item right now for lack of time. I want to make econometrics and statistics also endogenous. Econometrics is a branch of statistics, and statistics, from my point of view, is a branch of economics. I'll talk about that later on. Okay, back to imperfect markets. I think probably the most common conception of the relationship between macro and micro is that macroeconomics is an aggregate micro relationship. I believe that based on indirect, although of course there is something to that. My own feeling is that the relationship between the two is that macroeconomics is what the economic system begins to look like when you take full account of imperfect markets. Okay, and I'll try to demonstrate this for a few things. And in particular, what I want to do also is talk about the process of risk aversion. One of the conclusions I have come to in the past was the fact that people cannot really be risk averse according to this theory, since risk aversion is a kind of behavior that is selected out. In other words, if you have a group of agents who are risk averse and another group of agents who are risk neutral, larger and larger share of total wealth will accrue to the risk neutral agents. These would be the risk averse agents, and that kind of behavior tends to be selected out. Nonetheless, it's clear that a lot of phenomena in the real world seem to demand risk aversion, such as diversification of assets, higher rates of return on more risky type securities, buying insurance, and a rising yield curve. I think those are probably the major examples.
Can I clarify something?
Yeah.
Earlier we talked about utility as being independent taste, which is technology.
Well, taste or technology, according to this way of approaching the world. Yeah.
Okay, so now risk aversion is defined in terms of technology.
Okay. Let's suppose we have people who are maximizing wealth, all right? There's still a problem of, in case of uncertainty, exactly what do you mean by maximizing wealth? Are you maximizing the expectation of wealth? Are you maximizing some nonlinear function of wealth? And the point, I'm going a step further. I'm saying not only are you maximizing wealth, but you're maximizing the expected yield of wealth. In other words, no nonlinear utility function. That's the point I'm trying to make. And as I say, it seems to be prima facie incorrect, because you've got all of these phenomena which seem to indicate that for some strange reason people are risk averse. You know, it's just a brute fact of nature that turns out to be the case. what I want to show later on is that not only are people not risk averse, in fact they're actually risk neutral, but this kind of apparent risk averse behavior actually follows from in the presence of that's the thesis I want to promulgate. Okay, let's take a look at imperfect markets, and in particular the credit market. I mean, of all markets, the credit market is the least one, the least likely to be perfect. I mean, just think of what a perfect credit market would be. You walk into a bank, and you say, I borrow $10 million at the standard. They say, do you have any collateral? Who needs collateral? This is a perfect market. And then if you would super add to that the lifetime budget constraint, then the conversation would go on something like this. So it says, here's your $10 million. I see you're scheduled to drop debt next month, so be sure to repay it before then. okay. Now, talk about a rather simple model of the credit market, which tries to capture all this. Very, very
well, depending on the lender, there may be a contingent contract, but if you don't pay it back, you will drop it.
Fair enough. However, I do not believe that's a perfect capital model.
No, that's Guido's approach.
Okay. Suppose this is your lending at the. I think of a period. Okay, all lending is for one single period. You lend over here, positive or negative amount, and then you get back a result as a result of that. Okay, if so this is the amount of net lending at the present, or net loans, I should say, to stock. net loans, this is the net debt. This is present. This is chap. This is figure four on page seven. And this is, again, this is the future net loans and net debt. Okay, a perfect capital market would be one in which the relationship between these two is a straight line through the origin of slope one plus r. In the real world, this thing has to be a concave function and presumably has a lower limit. In other words, it's going to be exaggerated. It's going to be something like that. And there's going to be some credit limit beyond which you cannot borrow. And the rationale is simply the more you borrow, the less likely you are to pay back. And therefore, a lender will have to be compensated by a higher interest rate because of the greater and greater credit risk that's involved as more and more debt is being accumulated. Okay. So that's what I think is a fairly realistic picture. This is the sort of thing that I think should become standard in place of the fictitious lifetime budget constraint, which doesn't make any sense at all. Unenforceable, and certainly no institutional support for that concept work. Okay, now we come to risk aversion, and I write down there exactly what I said over here. You've got this conflict. On the one hand, risk aversion seems to be selected against, and on the other hand, there seems to be a lot of phenomena that seem to fall through. What I'm going to give you is an informal argument to indicate that if you've got an imperfect market, in particular, an imperfect capital market like this, where this is a strictly concave function, then you're going to get apparently risk-averse behavior. Okay, let's let x1 through xn be the various quantities of assets owned by an economic agent. The usual accounting way of figuring out your net worth is you just sum the prices of these things multiplied by the quantities. But it's not obvious that that's really an accurate way of assessing some wealth. I mean, basically, it's an accounting convention. That's the way an accountant will do it, for lack of anything better. But perhaps we can do it a little bit better. And the question is this. If you think of present wealth as the reflection of future wealth, then is this a correct way of measuring in the presence of an imperfect capital market? The answer is no. Suppose that you go one step in the future, and you're going to have your various stocks over here, including, I should say, not only physical assets, but financial assets. So your stocks and bonds. Financial assets could be negative, so that they could be liabilities. Suppose you measure your future assets according to standard accounting convention. In that case, your current assets cannot be measured in that way because there is a nonlinear conversion of current assets into future assets. And in effect, what's happening is you've got to, if you take a net creditor position, you have to have something like this. You're going to have a function V representing the various assets. And if Xn is net creditor position, then V will have to be a concave function of Xn, simply a reflection of this particular curve over there. Okay, so that's the first sort of step that you take. Then you can say, yeah, but wait a minute, the same argument applies again. Why should I measure this the way an accountant does? Maybe this itself has a nonlinear function. Well, you can try pulling the same trick again, something like this. I would postulate that this additive process is a pretty good approximation if you're relatively far into the future. So suppose that T time periods will have passed. You're in the future here somewhere, and suppose you evaluate this particular thing as PIXI. Then what does the initial function look like? And I don't give a formal argument. In fact, I try to set up a formal model, but things get complicated very rapidly. But here's an intuitive argument. Suppose that FT is this concave transforming wealth of time T into wealth of time T-plus, not wealth, sorry, but net credit to position or loans at time T into time T plus 1. Then it seems you've got this. Let's see, how do I start, let's, okay, here's my, okay. You've got that series of nonlinear transformations. This model is not strictly accurate because what you want to do is to introduce uncertainty into it, and you want to introduce the possibility of converting some of these financial assets into physical assets. That I'm not doing. So this is just intuitive. If these things, F1 through FT, are all increasing concave functions, then the composite function is an increasing concave function. So it seems that this particular thing carries over. Okay, now let's get the punchline. The conclusion is that this particular thing, V, reflecting your expected future wealth, is going to be a concave function of this thing over here, and therefore, somebody who is risk neutral as far as the future is concerned is going to be comparatively risk averse as far as the present is concerned, precisely because of the concavity of that. And therefore, it seems to me that you'll be doing all the kinds of things that risk averse agents are supposed to be doing. You'll buy insurance. You'll demand a higher rate of return on more risky stocks. You'll demand a higher rate of return if you have to wait longer for the return, and you will diversify. All of those things seem to be to follow from this. Yes?
I understand why the interest rate would appear as you have it here in the borrowing category.
Yes.
Why is the interest rate earned a decreasing function in your net wealth? I mean, if anything, I've seen arguments to the contrary, but
right.
I would accept linearity there.
I'm not worried about that.
Because you're saying,
why is it concave over
right,
here?
Because for individuals...
Make it linear, I don't care.
Right, but for individuals then who have net wealth positions, as long as they remain in that domain, in other words, individuals who currently have net wealth
right.
will behave as risk neutral.
That's that. Well...
Given your basic assumption
right.
that they're truly risk neutral.
Right, right. However,
people who have wealth should diversify.
No, wait a minute. We're not done yet. Remember, this is a multi-period model.
Yeah.
What you have to think about is there a positive probability that I will end up over here?
Well, I agree, but it depends on this, you know.
As long as there is a range in which unfortunate circumstances might plunge you, and as long as that particular range is strictly
since X is only accumulating in this model, not disaccumulating,
we don't know about accumulation, decumulation. What I want to do is to throw in uncertainty and the possibility of transforming assets from one form to another. And when you throw in uncertainty, it seems to me that there's always a positive probability of being down over here. And that's all I need. As long as I got a positive probability sometimes of being down over here, the whole thing is going to be strictly concave.
Unfortunately, we have reached a juncture here. It's 5:00, and there are people who still want to ask questions and so on. I think we'll just cut it off here and give Arnold his due, and then. And then, if there are people who want to continue on here at this stage, why don't we?